Oh, there we go. Stream is live.
Look at that.
I've set it up properly, which is a shock to everyone, I imagine. So, right. Well, I hope that there are some people with us already. I appreciate we're a couple of minutes early, but I think early is better than late. So we'll start with quick introductions, and we'll get into the conversation at past 12. So, hi everyone that is here. Welcome to the latest OT Security Connect webinar. My name's Elliot Davies. I'm the founder of cybersecurity recruitment business Quantahire and the OT Security Connect community. And today we're discussing the building blocks of ICS and OT cybersecurity. The OT Security Connect is a community of leaders from ICS, OT environments and practitioners. Really, we share knowledge and discuss shared challenges about the industry through webinars. I try to do them monthly, but I've got to be honest, the last few months have been a little bit lax, so apologies for that, but we will we'll resume the monthly sessions. So we've got today industry leaders from environmental services, transport, manufacturing, consulting, to talk us through the fundamentals of building cybersecurity through industrial control systems. And this will cover a variety of topics. It will include people and culture, risk management, and technical fundamentals, including defensible architecture, network security, incident response, and vulnerability management. So let's start and introduce the panel. They're all going to do a quick snippet to introduce themselves. So maybe if I hand over to Sam first, you can kick us off, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I'm Sam Taylor. I work for Infineon currently as a contractor. I am currently their CISO, as well as trying to run their project management function. So like doing the OT and cybersecurity for them. I have multiple arguments with myself. So from a CISO point of view, I'm telling myself to do something. And from a project management point of view, I tell myself that I don't want to do it. But yes, that's me. I previously worked at GSK as their OT cybersecurity program manager. And before that, Johnson Matthey, doing a similar role.
Lovely. Thank you, Sam. And Andres?
Yeah, I'm Andres Prieto. I work mainly in the IT space for all my life, except the last 10, 12 years. I moved into the dark side of the OT side, OT area, leading the infrastructure implementations and also OT cybersecurity part of it. So I'm there fighting with the goods and with the bads all around the globe.
Good stuff. Thank you. And Steph, over to you.
Howdy, I'm Stefano Saccomani. Sorry for the long name. I've been in the OT dark side space for over 25 years in rail. Mainly, my route has been through systems and systems delivery, rail control systems, if I'm honest. A little bit of water, SCADA, and a little bit of military aircraft. But that's led me in the latter years leading up cybersecurity teams, and I'm now an independent contractor who's actually on a rail project now, leading up the cybersecurity effort for a big job in Ireland. There we go. That's me.
Lovely. Thanks, Steph. And last but not least, Gavin.
Hey, I'm Gavin. I'm from New Zealand. Hence the weird accent, I suppose. I have been a operator, an industrial automation engineer, managing consultant, VSISO, professional services. I'm naturally the consultant in the room. I've pretty much done every position you can imagine in the OT space. And yeah, I've been in the industry for about 20 years. So not quite as much as Stefano, but getting there. I'm catching up.
Awesome. Okay, thanks everyone. So we'll get cracking straight away then. And we'll talk about laying the foundations around people and culture to begin with. And I guess why people are, you know, the biggest attack surface in OT security. But to get us started with that subject, I'll hand over to Sam just to kick us off.
Yeah, so one of the biggest things, you've got two people in the world. There's people that have been attacked and there's people that haven't. And the people that haven't have got this really, really strong sense of security that they think that they're invulnerable. And it's the same thing as, like, you know, you liken it to health. As soon as you have a health scare, you get really, really paranoid about everything that sits around it. And I think the one thing that you need to, within an organization, is to kind of give them that ability to understand that these things can happen and they will happen. And at the end of the day, you know, everybody has always looked at operational technology as being a completely separate part. It was completely, you know, separate. And at the end of the day, that was the one thing that protected us. Now, over the years, we've now started to get integrated because, in actual fact, it gets us efficiencies. Now, at the same time, those individuals are still thinking that, you know what, there's nothing that will happen. So that individual that will come on site with a USB drive, you know, a laptop or anything else, they will be fine. And that's the thing that you need to try and get over. So the way that I've approached it previously is I've worked with a number of organizations. And the first thing is just building up a relationship with the operational teams, understanding what are their overall pressures. And number one is availability. Like, that's the one thing that they're trying to drive. Second thing is just understanding what their overall pressures are, just day to day. So there's an awful lot that you have to build confidence as an individual coming in and trying to explain to them that this is a really, really important part of their day job, because it can affect availability. If your site goes down, and on average, you know, a ransomware attack will be 22 days, it means that your site will be down. And it's trying to drive that through. And do you know what? Every organization, it probably takes about 6 months to build up that overall relationship. The next thing is training, awareness. You know, I've done some bespoke training with individuals, which is fantastic. But, like, the awareness as well, making sure that they're thinking through every single decision that they make, and that they understand that there's a risk to doing, like, anything within the operational side. Any change that you make has got a risk. So any kind of, like, person coming on site is a risk. Any kind of cybersecurity event is a massive risk and could become an issue very quickly. So people are probably, and I've looked at NIST, and I've looked at IEC 62443, the biggest thing is 80% of it is people and process. 20% of it is probably technology, maybe a little bit less. And that's the thing that you need to kind of, number one, win people over, understand, like, how they can do things better. And it's so integral. And there's lots of courses that you can go on. There's lots of things that you can learn. And as long as you, like, start off with what are the individuals trying to achieve, which is keeping the plant up and running. So for us, it's energy to waste. So that's their main driver. So how do we kind of, like, bring cybersecurity into that and understand how we can help them with it? So it's, yeah, the people and people part is, it's probably the hardest. The technology is easy. I can put a new piece of technology in, you know, tomorrow. But if I don't get them on board, I don't get them kind of buying into it, then that's going to be my hardest job. So yeah, from the outset, every single program that I've ever run is target operating model. Get that sorted. Make people understand that they need to do things differently post the implementation of something, be it a policy, procedure, or a technology, and then go from there. But yeah, it's continues to be possibly the hardest thing, but it's also the most rewarding.
Where have you had success in starting that conversation? So how do you start to drive a change of culture and behavior?
So I think the first thing is you start to speak to the individuals. So you get to understand what they're about. So you talk to the individuals at site. That's number one. You build a rapport. Because if you don't have a rapport, you're not going to get anywhere. The third thing then is you can do a bit of a risk assessment. So you go through with them, kind of, what is their overall knowledge? Where do they sit right now? And then you go through that risk assessment. And then through that rapport, You then build out the requirements, and that's the most important thing. If you can get them into the requirements, fantastic. And then finally, you go back and you go, do you know what? We now need to set objectives and targets, because otherwise business change. It's like, I liken it. This analogy just is still not lost on me because I still can't get my kids to tidy their room. But it's like me saying to my kids, tidy room. And they go, why? And I go, well, like, I have no reason why other than I'd like your room to be tidy. If I give them objective and I say to them, do you know what? You can go to football because you've tidied your room. You could do this because you've done that. Like, and you build it out and you become really, really specific about it, then in actual fact, they will want to do it. But if you don't have the objectives, the targets, and everything else that builds around a target operating model, people will just go, I've got a piece of technology and I'm hoping that it's going to do everything for me. It's a silver bullet. And like we always say, cybersecurity isn't just for Christmas. It's for life.
It's for life. Absolutely. I mean, what's worked for the rest of the panel? You know, how have you managed to change the mindsets and to start to?
It's a good question. There's two approaches I've come across, really. One, for projects I've been involved with, they're very parochial in that they want you to look at their system and do a risk assessment against it, and they're not really interested in the wider piece, which is the crucial bit, the long-term management, the organisational setup to make sure they're looking after the cybersecurity piece. Or it's you can make a case that before you do anything on their systems, they need to have an assessment of their organization about where their deficiencies generally lie. And then you can delve into perhaps a risk assessment and such like. So my favorite approach on the organizational one is looking at exactly as Sam said, the NIST five pillars. I know it's got an extra pillar, but I like to stick to the five. makes sense to me. And then, you know, that might follow on to some more detailed stuff in terms of risk assessments for particular systems. Or it's the other way around. You get asked, well, this particular system we've got, we thought about it only just now. We need to do some cybersecurity. Can you do an assessment? So I do that. And then I said, well, this is all well and good, but at the back of it, you need to look after it. And perhaps you need a security concept of operations, you know, of how are you going to actually start raising procedures and policies that will look after the system that you've just had me risk assess. So that's generally how I look at it.
I think it's really important, the people and the culture, because it's where you get the most return of investment, no, that you do. So if you do it right in the beginning, it doesn't need to be very extend the cultural mindset. You just need to bring what we do on our daily basics for people on security. You don't leave your bank account open, you don't do these kind of things, just bring it back to the working site. If you do it right, that one, you reduce a lot your risk, and you will have, you know, an easier way of managing the rest of the activities and mitigate the rest of the activities. So the human foul, it's key for people and culture to have success on the OT security, cybersecurity.
I tend to agree with everyone on the panel so far. It's all good, you know, good advice that makes sense. You've got to hit those pain points, explain the process, given the why. I'm generally reminded of my operator days where I've seen some very entertaining, almost, you know, questionable activity. Purely because they've got a 12-hour shift and nothing to do. I have seen people limbo through safety curtains and get into a caged area with a robot still functioning, completely, blatantly a health and safety issue. And they're like, wow, I got time. I managed to get my way in there. So
practicing, you know, for the parties.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. And you think, well, people have this sort of approach to health and safety, which has been around for decades now. The cybersecurity side, again, explaining the why you shouldn't be doing that or should be doing that is definitely a major consideration. A lot of people bring in a USB stick and plug in it straight in, as Sam mentioned. You know, that's a near miss. Just because the malware didn't get triggered doesn't mean that what they've done is, you know, the correct method. So I find explaining the entire process of how we're going to do, you know, risk assessment, or sorry, gap analysis and like a risk assessment, get its target state architecture, and then we're going to be doing this the whole time. It's going to continue. And as I think Craig made a comment there, was it understanding the downtime of value of a cyber outage is a good way to explain what could happen in cost terms. And yeah, that cost can also help give the why. But you do have to have that personalized rapport, as Sam said, that one-on-one with people generally helps reinforce that. No, this isn't just some BS policy the company wants you to do. This is a thing, and it will continue to be a thing. And cybersecurity is everyone's responsibility, much like health and safety is everyone's responsibility. But the people and process is a massive one, and it is probably the hardest thing to get right, because people like to go through safety curtains, and the process is always hard to define. It's bespoke each time. So that's my comments.
I'm sure that safety curtains isn't one that you could necessarily second guess as well. Not something that you'd see coming. Just
no,
people will do that one. Random things. Yeah.
Yep. It's overconfidence, to be fair. That's the thing. Like people think that they're more confident, and therefore they will go through a safety curtain because they think, you know, I'm confident enough to be able to do this, and that's what's petrifying. So if they're willing to put their own physical safety, like, at risk, yep, that's the, you know, like it's so hard to then go, well, you can't plug your iTunes into the DCS.
Yeah. Exactly. Everywhere I've gone, and I'd recommend everybody do this in your control rooms, make sure you have the plugs, your electrical outlets. A lot of them have USB charging capabilities now. Most people are not allowed phones with them in the control room. It's banned. But on night shift, people know how to smuggle those things in, and because the footy's on and they need to watch the school. So make sure there is a place for them to just easily plug in and charge their phone. Otherwise, they will plug into the DCS.
So, yeah, you're right.
Pro tip.
Good stuff. We're gonna swiftly move the conversation onto risk management, and I guess prioritization as well, and ask Steph to kick us off with this. But I guess where we start is you know, how do organizations assess and prioritize risk in OT environments?
Yeah, good question. So my background is in rail, and rail is really old world. So by nature, we're 10, 15 years behind the curve on everything else that's out there, basically. And for a good purpose, because, you know, we want tried, tested equipment that's, you know, safe to use and such like. But it means that we're still in the world of isolated systems, or the thinking of isolated systems, not realizing that the systems we're putting in now are all pre-chipped, ready to go and connect on. So there's a big cultural shift that's needing to happen. We're not there yet. And it's the same for tackling. How do we go about looking at cybersecurity? So typically I'm called in to look at systems, and it's I don't even talk about risk assessments in the first instance. It's about, okay, identifying the system. And I align pretty much to the heavy duty engineering processes that we have, which are all related to safety and human factors and such like, which is, you know, bounding the system. What are we looking at? Questioning whether we've got a Purdue model. Very much not in the rail industry. So usually you have to create a Purdue model. And explain what that means, but it's quite understandable because, you know, we have safety integrity levels in rail. So it's a kind of rough equivalent to safety integrity levels that you can talk about security levels as well. So that's good. And then really, it's about having identified the boundaries, which you also do on the safety side. You look across the boundaries as well at the next level in, because you need to have a good idea of what's coming across those boundaries. And then you get stuck into a risk assessment. And generally, I will use, so it's 50701, which is the rail interpretation of 62443. And it's quite prescriptive about how you can go about that and what you're doing. And it's a framework, really, of how you go about and the evidence that you build in terms of risk assessing a system. And what that does for you, because I'm always Johnny come lately, I'm usually post, so I've very rarely been involved in upfront design discussions about cybersecurity. It's usually running alongside suppliers as they've got the design and looking through the risk assessment. And I always look from a system point of view. I'm doing my risk assessment. It's contextualized from a rail perspective so that I don't just look at the cyber risk and say, well, that's the cyber risk and therefore there's the mitigation against that from a cyber point of view. I'm looking at the risk from a rail perspective, a rail operational perspective, which contextualizes much more in terms of what that actually means to the whole organization. And again, it allows me to then plug into the safety side if there's anything I've got of concern that may have an impact and likewise. So there's a lot of structure around that, and I've flitted through it. So there's a lot of impact assessments and such like likelihoods and all that, and looking at the individual pieces of kit and usual that you all know about, which is conduits and all that, and looking at the layout of the architecture and system. So and pretty much looking at the boundaries, what's across the boundary. Doing all that risk assessment, it's laborious and there's lots of it, but it gives you a nice feel for where you're sitting. And then you have a conversation with the supplier about where they see they're sitting. It's very rare that I get a project that's actually set a security level target. Rail industry is pretty much, I'd say, we're all sitting at security level 2, I think. Very rare we talk about security level 3. But we're still in the world where we very much contain how we connect out from those systems. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen, because there's a lot of maintenance connections now starting to appear. And the proverbial of OT and IT convergence is happening. Woo, we're there. In fact, I'm looking at jobs now where they're talking about relying on cloud services directly into systems that are safety related. So that puts shivers up my back. So you need to spend a bit of time just really poring over that and going through that. In terms of, usually I take the risk assessment and it's build it into usually there's phases of project, a security management plan for each phase, and then I build into a security assurance case, which then gets usually presented at the same time as our safety case in a rail industry, so that they've got both. There's only three things they need in terms of going live with rail. It's really the safety of the system. It's the human factors. They're always interested in that because that has an impact on safety. And then it's the cybersecurity, are always the three questions they ask. I don't know if I moved away from the question, but that's...
no, not at all. And I think it's great because the point of the whole discussion is about building from the ground up, right? So you're coming at it from the very beginning, as you say, like coming in late and then reviewing everything before you start the risk management process. For the others on the panel, you'll be working with different frameworks, I guess, because Steph's got the rail specific one. What would you say is probably more transferable across other industries from a risk management framework point of view? Is it IEC 62443 is probably the more relatable one that can be applied across other companies and organizations, and that might be useful for some of the audience?
Before anyone else answers, generally I use NIST from an organizational point of view, and because I'm always dealing with rail stuff, it's 62443 and 50701, which is the interpretation. I come across ISO 27001, but that's only because I'm starting to see projects that are more IT based rather than OT based that are trying to break into the rail space, which is unusual. And again, back to the convergence issue. But they're all, obviously they all relate, and you can see the continuity, if you like, between the different standards and what they're all trying to hit the same thing, aren't they, really?
Anyway. So I guess the follow-up question would be, what other frameworks or complementary frameworks are there for early stage OT security?
So I would say in the first instance, a lot of organizations think that they are so I've worked for organizations where they think that when they've done the enterprise cybersecurity risk, that that's it. And then you go back to them and you go, well, there's this tiny little bit, which is your operations. And they go, well, no, but you've done the enterprise cybersecurity. And you go, well, no, that was just the IT side, which is a support function to the entire organization. We haven't actually looked at the operational side. And a lot of organizations are still in that phase. So they're not even looking at it. So you can use whatever framework you want. And you've got OG86, which is obviously for coma sites, and you've got all these various different like kind of guidelines. But a lot of organizations are still like very much, they haven't realized the risk that sits within their operations. And it's the bit that makes the money at the end of the day. So we've got an element that makes money. We've got a support function that we've very much protected, which is fantastic. So start with that. Go, hey, this is an entire function where you make your, well, in manufacturing and everything else, it's where you make your money. The next thing is, like the various different frameworks, I've created probably about four in the last different places that I've worked in to try and articulate it without overcomplicating it. Because the problem is every single like person will get fixated on one particular thing and they'll go, do you know what? That's the thing that I want. And you'll go, well, there's 562 controls. And that's where you've overcomplicated it to an overall board. So you need to kind of overall simplify what you're trying to do. And what I've tried to do in the last two organizations is take the risk, give them options, and then give them the ability to accept certain risks. And then other things, they need to make that decision of how much it's going to cost. Because at the end of the day, like you can't do everything all at once. I've sat in front of board of directors, and they've said, oh, just fix it. And I sit there going, no, it's not just a case of just fix it. We need to now kind of like work out what is the best bang for your buck. Because at the end of the day, you can't do everything at once. We need to like kind of look at the overall risks that the organization has and then work through it like kind of methodically. And then I'll give you an update and I've got the detail behind it. I can give you an overview at a high level because most of them don't care. I think the cyber security resiliency bill in the UK will make it more interesting. I think NIS2 made it more interesting because all of a sudden, if you are, if you don't follow it, the board is actually culpable for it. So like there's so much that it's trying to simplify the overall risks to the organization. Because otherwise they get so like hung up on this one tiny bit and you go, well, I can do that. But the other 52 controls, I'll just leave. It's fine. We'll just leave them till next year. So yeah, it's such a like risk management is probably the second hardest part, apart from people and culture.
Yeah, I think Stefano kicked it in one point that we have different frameworks for IT, for OT, for specific critical infrastructures and so on. And one of the challenges is to try to align all of them or make the correlation between them, because it's not easy. You cannot take NIS2 and make directly link to the ISE 62443, for example, right? So as a company, understanding what control are you doing in the ISE that could be linked to the NIST, that could be linked to the ISO, that's what it gives you the overview, right, about your cybersecurity posture as a company. And you don't need to reinvent the wheel. If you are touching with the ISE 62443 on the OT space, just link it to the NIST or link it to the other one, make the reference. Don't try to run NIST over the other one because you're duplicating efforts and over complex things.
I can echo everyone's sort of statement here. Everyone's pretty much nailed the I guess textbook approach. Gap analysis, risk assessments, communicating that risk, picking a framework. There's different ones. Sometimes you pick four and trip over yourself. What I have found is that, because obviously I'm in New Zealand, I do all Australia stuff. So we've got the SOCI Act in Australia and AES CSF. And once again, it's like another set of things you've got to consider that muddies the water, if you will. But fundamentally, when it comes to doing these frameworks and standards, you can do 62443 and then map it to NIST controls. You know, if you do 62443, you actually have actually done like the NIST risk management framework, you get the same result. So it doesn't matter if you do the NIST risk management framework and map it to 62443-3, like it's a bit weird. But what typically happens is IT have picked their controls and they want OT to match. 6443 is a great fit for that. So doing that process makes way more sense, but you can end up coming up with the same thing. As Sam pointed out, there is like 550 controls in this. So what typically ends up happening is either two things. One, you just go, we're going to more deliberately select 25 controls, explain what they mean, and explain at what risk level, low, medium, high, or 1 to 4, what that actually is. So endpoint protection, what does that mean at SLT2 or low? What does that mean at SLT3? So small 25 controls to select and try and manage, and that's their starting point. And they may look at the full NIST thing later, or 62443. The other thing that tends to happen is that maybe they've got 2700 series and the annex controls sitting there. Then it's a matter of mapping those exact controls. It's like, okay, we've got IT controls. How do we OTify them? So it's sort of the same process. Like, how do we actually make these controls work? Are they applicable? And you may even throw like, yes, endpoint protection again. And it's super important. SLT2 and above, our PLCs are SLT2. But they're on Purdue level 1, therefore doesn't apply. That type of thing. Okay. all of that is quite useful to do. And lots of companies have these different approaches. Now, the one thing that I'll say about risk management is that the entire process tends to cost a lot of money. You've either got a CISO or a consultant or someone with the technical expertise to actually run the system, that can cost tens of thousands of quid. I think I got that right properly. So, yeah, it's not a cheap way to do it. So if you're starting out, what do you actually do? Like, let's say you're an engineer on site, you're passionate about cybersecurity, you want to protect your control system. What do you actually do? So there's the SANS top 5 critical controls. You could do that. It's a good starting point. Personally, for me, when I was starting out, the first thing I did, the first thing was always disaster recovery. Do I have configs of my industrial network switches? Can I restore those? Can I restore my SCADA workstation? And having that 3-2-1, three copies of data, two places, one offline and offsite, ideally, that would be my starting point. Start there, and then that sort of helps you sort of think about your asset inventory at the same time, because you're thinking, oh, Where are my assets? Where are my devices? And then you sort of get in your asset inventory and making sure you've got a backup. So it's a two-prong approach there. And then you move on to other things like, okay, border control. How are my contractors coming in? How am I getting data in and out? But I've been speaking for like probably 20 minutes straight, so I better pass it.
It was 20 minutes of gold, Gavin, so thank you. What I'm just going to go quickly to questions. We've got a question from Steve about your thoughts about the adoption of the NCSC CAF to demonstrate government's controls against NIST2. Does anyone have any thoughts about adopting that?
So it depends. It depends if you're an essential service or a critical national infrastructure, and also that you are abroad. So NIST2 doesn't apply to the UK. So luckily, I don't need to comment.
Yeah, CAF is interesting. In terms of, again, it's broad categories again. I don't tend to get involved in that. It seems to sit at a higher level of responsibility, shall we say, on a OES. So they're looking at their general categories and what they're reporting. I tend to get involved at the lower level. So the 6443 side of it, organisationally, NIST I use, as I've said before. So, but it's all, you know, you can do that translation between them and see how you cascade through CAF into what it is you're doing at 62443 level. Yeah.
And GAF's quite nice, actually. Like, it's quite a friendly audit. You can do yourself initially, and then when you do get audited, you need to make sure that you feel confident that you've answered the questions truthfully. But yeah, it's one of the more, it's like OG86, the HSE's version, so the Health and Safety Executive. That one is, again, it kind of draws out whether or not you're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Okay.
If any of you are working in America, I'd pay attention to any state laws as well. So you have the generic federal stuff, and then you have the individual state laws as well, which just complicates it even more. And they tend to be more IT-based if it's, even though you're working in an OT space. So they tend to look at everything from that perspective.
Great stuff. Okay. Thank you, Brian. Hopefully, Steve, that helps to answer the question. We were moving on to the technical fundamentals now, defensible architecture and network security. And Andres is going to kick us off with this. So we touched earlier about the SANS 5 critical controls. Is this a good place to start for defensible architecture and getting your technical fundamentals in place?
Yeah, I mean, those five critical from SANS are a good starting point, as it has been mentioned also here. No, there's a few tips there. Obviously, we're speaking about risk assessment, about prioritization. You need to know what you have, right, in order to understand what is your risk level, how the assets are displayed on your OT environment, and I think nowadays visibility and monitoring of what's on your environment, plus a proper asset inventory in place, is key to be able to move forward with your cybersecurity program and your cybersecurity posture, no, on the company. You start from a basic segmentation for this IT and OT classic one. Now with the convergence, we're seeing more and more interoperability between them. It needs to happen in the safest way, in the best way. And it's always important to have those controls there. There are several options you can apply, like the firewall traffic, the DDoS communications going out. It's all together, as much you get segmented, as much you get visibility what's going on your side, you will be able to prioritize easier what are the activities you need to apply. So you don't need to patch quickly everything, for example, or you have a 0 days. Having the visibility of how things are going, how communication is happening on your OT environment, and if something is weird happening again, give you some hints to prioritize and to have a look where you need to take care of. And also, proper segmentation in place allows you to have a more secure remote access and control the remote access from the different vendors, which I think for most of us is the biggest headache, no? All of those VPNs that you might have connected to your OT environment for remote access. I call it Wild Wild West, but sometimes it's what they have there. But you need to have control of them. You need to see what they're doing. You need to approve those connections. You need to make sure nothing is going to interrupt your business, right? So I think it's key to have a proper design architecture in place. I'm a fan of segmentation or micro-segmentation in most cases without affecting the safety of your environment. Because I suffer a lot sometimes where you are in a flat network per Purdue level, things like that, that you don't want that. You suffer some stuff. So segmented as much as possible with a control way, having in mind your process, your line process, and your safety of your factory, it's key. I don't know what the other guys think about it.
Yeah, so one of the biggest things that I would say is when you have a site commissioned, number one is when they hand over, there's probably going to be a lot of remote connections that were still in there. So that's number one, is what you thought you had is probably not what you have. So to Andreas's point, asset management and knowing exactly what's in that environment is kind of key. The second thing is, we've got to remember that at the end of the day, if you've got an OT environment, the main thing is availability. So that's all they're looking for. So therefore, they will find a way to plug something in. And, you know, we've seen it across a multitude of different organizations, is somebody will plug something in because it works. So it's now in the IT network, or it's you know, directly connected to the internet, just because that machine needed to work. And now it works, and that's fantastic. But you've now introduced a security risk. It doesn't represent the architecture that you originally had. And it's all of those things. It's the changes. It's the small changes that introduce risk after risk after risk that you're trying to constantly battle with. And that's so hard from an architectural point of view. And then it's back to your point, Andreas, from the start, is let me know what your assets are. Let me know what it's connected to, and then go from there. But yeah, it's compared to IT networks that are normally quite generally well mapped out, because they were always connected to the internet. So they've got the firewalls and they've got everything else in place. The OT is just, I just need this to work. Machine isn't working. This is how I'm going to make it work. Just plug this dongle in. It now works. I'm good.
And I found very interesting the visibility part, or the monitoring part. There are several appliances on the market that give you that one, because you can also get those alerts about when something was, you know, on one network, on one connected, it should be live, and suddenly it's no longer live, and it's because switch is broken, they connect somewhere else to get up and running, you know, report on whatever. Having that visibility layer on it, it could help a lot, and it could save a lot of, not fixing the problem, but at least understanding, knowing something has changed there. That it shouldn't, so I can come back and avoid the main issue.
Yeah, and then there's a remote access, but like that's just a whole other topic that is just, you know, I can just dial in, and I've got an agreement that says that I will tell you before I do it. And you go, that's fantastic.
The main problem with remote access is that sometimes when you buy equipment, is the only way they have to connect, or the way they sign off to connect to meet SLAs, to support and so on, is with those, you know, VPN, callback VPN, pre-modern, full modern. I mean, I always say the same thing. The last resource is someone with a cable plugging in, plugging out, plugging in, plugging out. A process in place is not clever, but it saves you sometimes, you know, something being left there.
Yeah,
I also find that there's a real lack of understanding of where you can leverage security on some of the network connections. So I'm seeing a lot of MPLS systems being implemented now, because, you know, they're great for protocol. Lots of different protocols can be run through them, and I'm seeing MPLS where they're missing the opportunity on the boundary to actually instigate a security stack. So you can monitor things coming in and out, and that's useful. But people don't tend to do that. I've only seen that in a few occasions. Simple things like that. Just take into account where your boundaries are and making sure that you take the opportunity. If you install the equipment and they've got capabilities, you might be able to leverage something on that in terms of security. So paying attention, as well as all the things that Andreas talked about, which is, you know, the segmentation and such like.
I was just going to take a moment just to say thank you to the anonymous recommendation on the LinkedIn Q&A. But has anyone implemented diodes or unidirectional gateways before?
So this statement right here is completely false for various reasons. One, it comes down to risk. Do you need to put a unidirectional gateway or data diode in? That's really a risk question. So the second thing is, if you've ever gone down the path of trying to purchase a unidirectional gateway, you quickly realize that you could spend that £30,000 on unidirectional gateways or data diodes. You can spend that £30,000 training your staff on people and process, which is going to have a far better result in the long run. Firewalls are far cheaper to implement, and remote access is almost always required. I think COVID taught us that. So I do like unidirectional gateway technologies. I generally do. They do lower your risk, but there's still mitigating circumstances that generally rules it out of the majority of most organizations. And you've also got to take into effect that realistically, only oil and gas and energy can implement these. They're the only ones that have the budget.
I would hope nuclear.
Nuclear is one of those ones where you're like, yeah, you know what? Unidirectional gateway. You probably even skip the risk assessment process and go, let's start with that.
Yeah. And then, I wish that was the case.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest one of the biggest challenges of all of this we're discussing here is this IT/OT convergence and how things are moving more into data connectivity, cloud. I fully agree with you, Stefan. I don't see a cloud thing managing your factory yet. It's been there, it's been proposed there for business, but as you need to increase that connectivity, that visibility to upper system to lower systems, the challenge of the security and segmentation is even more. So that idea, it works for specific cases, but it will not work for everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is a water company that has got its DCS in the cloud, which, all of us are probably terrified by.
Yeah. Well, I know Alstom are playing with safety interlockings in the cloud as well. So that terrifies me. I have done a data diode early days, and I'll agree with Gavin, it just depends on the risk profile really, and we've kind of moved away. I mean, there's lots of data dual directional data diodes out there, and they are expensive. Blue Iguana is one of them, and that kind of stuff. Or was it Iguana Blue? I can't remember. Anyway, there are products out there, but we've tended to move away from that. We're still very much in the rail space, onto jump servers in DMZs, where you're downloading and then you pull manually that information in, because we get too hyper if we have a proxy server sitting somewhere. And to tell the truth, I'm not that keen on just a transparent proxy server just cascading straight into a signaling control system. So it just depends really.
Thank you guys, and thanks for the comment. We, keeping an eye on time, are going to move into the incident response and vulnerability management side of the discussion, which I'm going to ask Gavin to kick off, but maybe we'll start with incident response plans. And in many businesses maybe don't have one, and I guess your thoughts on that and what should be included really.
I was going to just derail that completely and actually go the other way and talk about vulnerability management as a rail joke for Stefano there. The reason why I wanted to touch on the vulnerability management side just quickly is because it falls into that network sort of monitoring visibility. A lot of people, when if asset inventory is mentioned, which was by Andreas, I almost always immediately say, asset inventory also includes your software list. Like it's standard. A lot of people forget that. They just think it's the hardware and what operating system you're running. And the software list is a big component of the vulnerability management and, asset inventory. So what you do for vulnerability management is you actually have to go and find that data out in order for you to have an effective vulnerability management program in OT. You're going to have to get that data, and it's probably going to be automated, and that scares a lot of people, but it can be done. 2008-2009 we used to use SNMP to poll the network switches, and that would go into the OPC server. The OPC server would then display the network state on the SCADA screens. So reaching out onto an OT network can be done. You just got to be very, very careful with how you do that. The same goes for your operating systems and software list and firewall network devices. So getting that will help you do a risk-based vulnerability management program. What is a risk-based vulnerability management program? You don't just go CVE-9, I need the patch. You actually need to go, well, what's the downtime to operations? Is there compensating controls that we've already got in place? That means we don't have to patch. Can we just have increased monitoring? There's lots of things that come into that decision. And I'd say 98% of the patches get thrown out, and you just focus on what you can actually achieve to reduce your risk. Okay. And like I said, most of the time you need an outage. So that's a big risk to take into factor. Incident response. Slightly different. You've gotten hit. The stands critical controls sort of number one is incident response plan. What I found works best is to actually kick off with a tabletop exercise and just grab your IT ones. You know they're going to be ineffective. It's very, very eye-opening for everybody on how that's going to work. I suggest you check out ICS for ICS. It's Incident Command System for Industrial Controls. And it says, we've already got a command system in place, okay, how to run an emergency event, because we're dealing with a lot of physics. Like if it's a waste treatment facility, right, that's a sewage spillage. You're going to have to get civil defense in, right? How do we control that emergency environment? Cyber's kind of the same thing. And when you've got OT plus cyber, it's definitely a physical thing to kick off. So those are the sort of the starting points. Tabletop exercise, expose how your IT procedures are probably going to be inadequate and what needs to change to make them good for OT. And then look at something like ICS for ICS, because it'll be a great system to run. Because if there was an event for your critical infrastructure, you'll probably be calling in emergency services, civil defense, a few other things to restore your operations. I'll pass it back to the panel.
Got a question generally for everyone. So in terms of, and I think I already know the answer, I'm just wondering in your space, if you ever come across a runtime endpoint protection running? In OT, I don't believe you do. Well, certainly not my space. You know, we have endpoint protection, or seeing it starting to be introduced, because we're still behind the curve, of course. but we want that ability to isolate before we actually do any updates and such like. So that's our response. But just wondered if you guys have come across something that actively does things on the fly.
I've seen EDR on level 3. Very, very rarely at level 2 of the Purdue model. I think what's more effective or a safer approach is application allow listing. It's not perfect. Like most lists, more exceptions get added and then added again and added again. It's where that process comes in once again, where we come back and review, are these still valid? Are these exceptions just meant to be temporary? So that life cycle is hugely important. But yeah, endpoint protection, EDR, I have seen it at level 3, and increasingly, despite last year's events, every vendor has caused that issue. But yeah, essentially, it is coming deeper into the stack, if you will, the Purdue level. One key thing, sorry, I know, Gavin, you're hogging the whole thing again. one key thing with the CrowdStrike issue was if you went for an N-2, it was ineffective. Due to the channel updates, just didn't follow that. But the N-2 approach, you didn't get that retainer or that. A lot of people counted on the fact that they would get that pulled for incident response and the bucket of money, and you don't actually get that with N-2. You have to be at N-1. So that was one of the biggest findings we found through that exercise.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no. So we're using actually an endpoint protection that's more looking at the network, because one of the big things that the OEMs don't like is to actually put any endpoint protection onto their devices, because they believe that will probably knock it out. But there are solutions out there, which I can talk to you about afterwards, Stefano. Sorry, Andres.
Yeah, I've seen systems we have EDR or AV, you know, even level 2. Environments and situations, PC servers. I think I haven't seen too much issues about, you know, in modern stuff, CPU, RAM going crazy and so on. I think the more risky is on the policies that you apply to those of them. So on the ICS, you cannot just lock files, you know, quarantine files, delete files just because they are claimed they are bad. I think you need a good benefit of it is that they alert you and you know what you have there. Doesn't mean that the incident response is the same table of scenarios as in the IT, that is isolated, deleted, and no, it cannot work in the same way, right? But you want to know what you have there. Obviously not everywhere, and we came through OM that they don't want, you know, the EDR install name and so on. More and more often they are going through that one because, you know, more and more often they are realizing they need to be there. Most of them, they allow the whitelisting, blacklisting, and again, I agree with with a comment, not that if you whitelist one thing and another one, and you never review that, you end up into an open, you know, kind of a space situation. But I haven't faced a lot of problems because of performance on systems. I see more about IT policies configuration push to the OT environment that is causing the problem and the damage. And that's where we're going back to the cultural thing. We're going back to the IT-OT convergence thing. I don't think it's bad to have a mix of things. I think it's, but the cultural mindset needs to change first. Otherwise, you will mess up a lot of things.
It's going to refer to the last question we've just had. Do you know of ICS or IT tabletop organizers to recommend?
Immersive labs are good if you want to spend money. If you want to do something for free, then I think, is it the NCSC does a something in a box. I can send you Timu. I'll find you afterwards, and I can send you the link. But it's pretty good. Yeah, and it will give you an overview. And then there's loads of organizations. I'm just about to do one with the extended leadership team. So the one thing about incident response is so key is, number one is you get the board ready to do one, but then you need to get the teams ready, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to be on actually doing it at the time. So the board can be ready, but if the teams on site don't know what to do, i.e., turn that firewall off. So in actual fact, now you're in island mode. Then that's the critical piece that you always need to think about within incident response. If they're not practicing it, it's the same thing as disaster recovery and business continuity. If they don't know what to do, like it's a cybersecurity event is the same as just a power outage or anything else. It can be worse. But Timu, I'll find you and I'll send you through the link.
Yes, it's rather you got to fire drill that stuff. It's, you know, you got to practice. They got to know what they're doing. Yeah.
It's the same as everything else. Like as an ex rugby player and as Sir Clive Woodward, and I know that this will pain you, Gavin, because you're New Zealand. Is like it's trying to expect the things that will happen. That was always the thing. Like, drill that into your brain is always like expect the unexpected, and everything else, as long as you practice it, you will probably be fine. But if you don't practice it, it's going to come unstuck very quickly.
I think you mentioned how, you know, most people island, and that is a good defensive tactic, you know, just pulling the cable, practicing that. One of the first things I've during these tabletops, they're like, okay, we're gonna island. It's like, are you aware of malware detonation? And they're like, what does that mean? It's like, it's beacons, and if it loses its beacon, it detonates. So by islanding, you could trigger, and they're like, oh, we never knew you could do that. It's like, ah, so now you do. So now you've got to factor that in. But that's that awareness, as you say. So the expected, unexpected. As for tabletop organizers, I know ThreatGen has a tabletop. That seems to be all right. And again, money, if you've got money. What I tend to have done in the past is I've grabbed CSERS pre-built tabletop exercises. I found them very, very complicated. And so I stripped them down and made them very, very simple and have like three injects. And just because people are just starting with these tabletop exercises, you don't want to like have to bombard them with everything. So yeah, I'll try and find the CSERS website. They've got some pre-canned ICS OT ones.
Lovely. Okay. Well, we're drawing right to the end. I think it's probably a good time to conclude and say thank you to everyone that's joined and particularly to the panel. Thank you for sharing your time and your insights and your expertise. We'll be back again soon with another webinar in a few weeks. We'll be discussing free ICS OT cybersecurity boot camps provided by Hacktonics, which is a really interesting initiative in the UK Great opportunity to get free training on site with PLCs and sort of OT equipment set up there. I'll have some more announcements coming up on LinkedIn with regarding that session and obviously the Hacktonics plan. Thank you everyone for joining. If you want to reach out to any of us, the community is really about networking and connecting and learning opportunities. So please do feel free to reach out to me or the panel today if you want to connect or talk. And I really appreciate everyone's time. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys. Thank you. And bye. We'll speak soon. Thanks.
Cheers.
Was still live.
I've just